Greetings once again and welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips-Wefferson coming at you once again from beautiful Atea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand, where last night I watched an extraordinarily beautiful full moon rise and very, very, very beautiful. I've seen a lot of rainbows lately. Saw my first bumblebee of the spring yesterday. Little honeybees have been coming to visit beautiful flowers. It's not too cold anymore. This show is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 291. It's called Asking More of Ourselves. This show is a follow-up to my really cool interview with Fritjof Capra last week, which turned out really, really fantastic in many ways. And I've got word from Fritjof and his associate, Joan, that they are definitely interested in continuing this as an ongoing series of interviews. And he was really happy with how it turned out and very excited about that. But in honor of his concept of a transformative learning community, which I really think of, that's, isn't that what the Earth is? I mean, from the anthropogenic perspective, from the mainstream anthropogenic perspective, regardless of what people say, the bottom line is our attitude towards the Earth and being here now is that it's a resource for us to consume, a contrivance of nature that's our planet, that is where we're destined to be the overlords. But if you look at being here now from a more enlightened and spiritual perspective, you could think of a transformative learning community not as something that we need to go and create, but something that already exists. And this is one of the ideas that I'm going to talk with Fritjof about, is the what exactly do we mean by community, and expanding our, what Carl Sagan, the astronomer, it was an expression that I first saw him use in a pamphlet about the dangers of nuclear war back in the mid-1980s. He said we must expand our horizons of identity. That means what we think of, or who we think of as us, as ourselves, as our, as an individual person or being in our immediate family, and to expand that to include the community of life, which is really a physical reality on this planet. But that's one of the main ideas. But asking more of ourselves, you can think of it, what I'm about to share, as a sort of a meta program of consciousness enhancing algorithms for re-navigating the human process. Now, this is definitely not some kind of Jeff's version of sort of EST, Earhart Seminars Training, or all the other myriad self-help, life coaching kind of things that have come and gone all through the New Age yuppie community in the 1990s and well on into now. I mean, you couldn't possibly catalog all that stuff, but it's all oriented towards the very limited modern-day version of the self, you know, looking out for myself, the Al Franken generation, for me, Al Franken, remember the guy from Saturday Night Live? This is nothing like that, least of all, in the sense, is it anything that I am even remotely capitalizing on, which all these self-help things, it's like, you know, give me your money and I'll tell you, I'll share all this secret information with you that'll help you get on top of the heap. But, you know, EST, I had some friends that actually paid, I don't know how much money, to go and become a part of that in Atlanta back in the late 1980s. And they came out of it and they said that the fundamental premise of EST is the belief that all people, all the people they care about are motivated by three fundamental drives or urges: to look good, to feel good, and to be right. And I was just stunned when I heard that. I get like, how blatant can someone be of the totally selfish, malignantly narcissistic perspective on relating with other people and stuff like that. So this is nothing like that. In fact, I share a very high degree of indignation at that whole kind of thing. Nor is this a cult. Like, you know, a cult is kind of like, well, this is something I talked about in an interesting interview I did with Nigel Gray that has not yet been broadcast. He's actually quite an aware activist, especially in the dimensions of geophysical warfare here in New Zealand, but he's also a member of an organization which, you know, if you ever ask me to name a cult, I would say Scientology. And he's a Scientologist, but, you know, as he explained it, people think of it as a cult, but probably the mainstream mentality of today in the climate change era, the mainstream mentality has all the salient characteristics of a cult in the same way that capitalism has all the salient characteristics of a religion. But he says Scientology is not really a belief system, but it's sort of like a school of thought that helps people be more aware of their own psychological process. And if that's really true, then, you know, anything that can help us in that kind of way is a value. And that's what I'm trying to do with this show. Whereas, you know, a religion, you know, you've got the self-help things like EST, you've got cults. Religions are kind of like cults in the sense that they're, you know, there's a lot of different ones, but the basic thing is you've got these authoritative leaders, priests, nuns, monks, preachers, all this different kind of stuff. And they're the sort of the brokers of the God wisdom, or the authoritative figures whose word you have to just take on literally on faith. And it's all about the dogma, the doctrine, and the belief, and what you can assimilate and walk around and share with your consensus reality friends and family of the church, rather than critical thinking or trying to delve more deeply into the what it really means to be here now. This approach that I'm sharing is in the spirit of a true internal application of the scientific process, not in the sense of getting funding from the government and setting up your own research institute, but in the sense of the inquiry to try to gain more insight and knowledge and understanding of what's going on. And our psychology, from the perspective of what you can do to understand your own psychology versus what you could get someone else to do to or for you, not the latter but the former, trying to understand your own psychological process is probably one of the most important things that we can do in terms of being here now as human beings, because everything else we do, short of relying on the fact that we're living, breathing beings, which is in itself a marvel, that we don't have to consciously tell ourselves to breathe and every cell to metabolize, and we don't have to tell each muscle how to contract and each neuron how to fire. Given that all that is harmoniously taking place to greater or lesser degrees, we're able to sort of drive our human vehicle. But our psychology, our mental processes of perception and awareness and sensation and memory and communication and reality building, these are essential to everything we do, even dreaming. But every single thing we do, regardless of whether it's good or bad, sideways, up, down, black, white, in or out, backwards or forwards, past, present, future, or at really odd angles to itself, everything we do and think and conceive and every single thing is rooted in our psychology, which is in itself a very important insight, but not the main topic of this show. As I've kind of alluded to and expressed on numerous shows, and in recent years I've become a bit, probably disenchanted is probably a bit mild for how I feel about my fellow human beings in general. And not really specifically, in terms of like most of the people that I know personally in my life are actually quite really nice and cool people. I could give some examples to the contrary, but those are exceptions to the rule. And you can't say all people this or all people that. I mean, of course you can say it. People say it all the time. People say like, oh, well, people, blah, blah, blah. And I go, but look, how many people have you actually met or know or have any connection with out of the however many who exist? And that's another big question there. How we take that on faith, along with millions of other things, that anybody knows how many people there are. And it's always touted as we've got too many people, overpopulation. But you know, have you gone and counted even the people in your town? How could anybody actually really possibly know? It's all based on bureaucratic documents and statistics and records and all this different kind of stuff like that. But how accurate could that possibly be? And how easy would it be for that kind of information to be manipulated on behalf of whoever might want to do the manipulating to serve any kind of agenda at all? But I have, just based on my own experience and what I see people doing with their lives, that's the crux of this whole show. What are we doing with our lives? Why are we here? How do people spend their time? What's important to them? What are they making real? What are they neglecting? So I'm trying to focus all this. I deal with the stuff we're doing bad or wrong a lot on this show. But in honor of the transformative learning community, I'm trying to make a very concerted effort on behalf of my fellow man, who I haven't totally lost faith in humanity. It seems to be decreasing as time goes by, just by a sheer example. But then, you know, I'll always, like, for example, last week when I was in Auckland, I was really dreading going, and I never liked Auckland, and I don't like cities. But because of everything that happened, it actually turned out to be quite an almost positive experience in terms of the energy that it left me with and how nice all the people were and everything. So, you know, I'm not going to say it restored my faith in humanity. And you see people doing individual examples of kindness and altruism and compassion and putting their life on the line and service beyond the call of duty. And I could give a lot of examples of those. And I talk about well-known people like that. I call them the Rachel Carson of today. Again, that's a topic for another show. Little, beautiful little bird has just come into my kitchen, a banded rail. He's walking around, nibbling up some little crumbs on the kitchen floor. This show, asking more of ourselves, is to try to get people to take a look at what you're doing with your life, because it's really interesting. Back in the year 2000, when I was very first in Australia, I was painting my first murals in Noosa on the Sunshine Coast. And there was this bloke that used to come around every day. His name was Bill. And I wasn't sure what he really did. He didn't seem to have a job or anything, but he was, you know, reasonably intelligent. He wasn't a street person. He lived with his dad. And one day he came in there and started talking, and he was all bummed out. He was just really sad and even angry. And I go, like, Bill, what's wrong? And he goes, like, they're shafting me, they're shafting me. And I go, like, who? And he goes, Centrelink. And at that time, I didn't know what Centrelink was. No, it's not the bus transport, public transport in Australia. Centrelink is the Australian dole board that hands out the money to all the people, all the bludgers and the people that have legitimate needs for money from the government. Centrelink is who hands all that out. I don't know what it's called in New Zealand or America. But it sounds like it should be transport, but it's not. It's the transport of money to people. And it's a very exploited system. And this is an example. Bill said, I asked him what was wrong, and he goes, Centrelink shafting me. And I go, like, well, what are they doing? He explained to me who they were. He was getting his dole money, even though he was living with his dad, getting his money from Centrelink. And he goes, like, Jeff, they're going to make me start having to work a few hours a week picking up rubbish at the hospital in order to keep getting my dole check. And I go, but, dude, what's wrong with that? That's actually a really good idea. But to him, it was the end of the world. They were shafting him by making him have to do a few hours of work to get free money that he didn't need for a living. He said he saved this money up to go skiing. So that this was 19 years ago in Australia. So it would have only gotten worse since then. But anyway, I told this little story to the bloke that owned the fruit and veg shop next door. He sort of took me under his wing. His name was Tony Crowhurst, a very legendary Australian, one of my earliest friends that I made there. He used to be a professional rugby player, and he owned a fruit and veg shop, and he was also a didge player. He sort of took me under his wing, and he referred to that Bill guy as an oxygen thief. So that was the very first time I ever heard that expression, but it makes a lot of sense. And so in recent years, the more I see people in general, what they're doing with their lives and what they aren't doing, they're oxygen thieves, you know. And this is not a judgment, it's an observation based on who am I to judge? Not at all. These are observations or evaluations on trying to make a reasonably intelligent assessment of what's happening with humanity on this planet right now, our planet, if according to us, and what the problems are. And just in general, I see humanity, modern humanity, I'm not talking about indigenous people that are still hanging in there by a thread, trying to live in their old ways, and even though that's a very complex topic in itself too, very few truly indigenous people still exist or could exist. Even once they've been discovered and filmed by David Attenborough's BBC film crew, they cannot be indigenous anymore. That's another story in itself too. Oxygen thieves. So I see so many people that's really, they qualify as nothing more than that. I also heard the expression back in America, a guy was talking about some losers that he knew, and he said they were a waste of protoplasm. So that's another interesting way to look at it. So I still have faith in humanity. I have faith in my friends. I have faith in our innate goodness as beings. But I'm also very realistic about what the prognosis seems to be for the absolutely essential change or renavigation of the human process that's necessary for us to turn back from the brink of oblivion that we're clearly on. The more I learn about the dangers, the real global threats to life that our species is creating through the military, industrial, technological juggernaut that's just running off the rail, and so many people are oblivious to this. So I'm going to explore a little of what I see as algorithms for renavigation or ideas to be aware of to evaluate how you might be able to be inspired to ask more of yourself in terms of what it means to be here now as a human person. And it's really interesting. I've been thinking along these lines, and there was a comedian, truly a philosopher of comedy and a philosopher in the true sense. His name was George Carlin, Carlin, and he was huge all through the X-Files generation in the 90s. You could have seen him on TV, Saturday Night Live, and he had his own show, and he was quite brutal and quite obscene at times and really funny, but he also had really important messages. And one time I was watching a show, and his final message at the end was to everyone, he said, ask more of yourself. Ask more of yourself. And that just really stuck with me because it makes so much sense, because it really reflects on the fact that not many people are asking much of themselves at all. In fact, au contraire. So this show is an attempt to get people to just ask themselves how much they're asking of themselves, and to be inspired to see if you might be able to ask more of yourself, because otherwise, why are we here? Are we here to just be units or a cell in the Homo sapien macro virus, this planetary blight that's laying waste to everything all over the whole planet right now? Is that our highest purpose or calling? Because it really is what a lot of the summation of our time and energy is going to, regardless of what we think of it. I think that's the reality that's being experienced by Mother Earth and our fellow life forms, that we're a destructive, invasive parasite that's acting like a cancer that's spreading over the whole planet. So I still have some faith in humanity, but I personally think that it's too late for us to renavigate. And as I've talked about a lot before, I think there's two things important to realize: that every thought we think in every person's brain and mind matters. So many people think that their existence just doesn't matter, and it's not like they're worried about not existing anymore, or that they're nihilists or existentialists or anything like that, but they just don't care. They aren't concerned about it. And but more importantly, I think that if we're walking around on our highest path, doing our best, we're sending out sort of a holographic field of coherence that sort of brightens and enlivens not only our individual lives and those around us, but all of humanity and the whole spectrum of life and consciousness. And it helps everyone to have a clearer perspective and a more real picture of the big picture worldview. And for every ounce of oblivion and selfishness that people walk around with, that's sort of like a lead weight of consciousness that makes you a better oxygen thief and makes your protoplasm even more wasted. Buckminster Fuller, the sort of Dymaxian Leonardo da Vinci systems thinker of the 20th century, that invented the geodesic dome and had buckyballs named after him. But my favorite quote from him is, "On spaceship Earth, there are no passengers. Everyone is crew." So that implies that rather than being excess baggage, which most of us would largely qualify for on spaceship Earth, and we aren't even being charged for it, what if we had to pay for our own excess baggage contribution to Mother Earth? Most people would be being shafted by Centrelink. But it's to, in the words of Thomas Bunyakya, the Hopi elder, to lessen the severity of the purification. The day of purification being when Mother Earth and the Great Spirit cleanse the Earth of all that's out of balance with life. And there's no way that we can prevent this from happening. It's a necessary step. An epileptic seizure of Gaia that allows all the diseased artifacts and debris and tumorous presence of civilization to be cleansed from the earth, so that the new dreaming might emerge and life can be reborn, and the people of one heart might be the seeds of the new creation. And people doesn't necessarily imply human beings. The East Coast whale-dreaming people of Australia have said for many, 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 many thousands of years that whales and dolphins were people before us, that they taught our ancestors how to become people. So anyway, through the summation of anything good we can do, beginning with ourselves, we might hope to lessen the severity of the purification, which means that more innocent life forms who are already suffering because of us, their lives might be spared and less damage done to them because of what Mother Earth is going to have to do to get rid of us, our deeply entrenched military-industrial juggernaut that's just becoming a robotic AI terminator growth all over the whole planet. The usual strategy for presenting an argument in as like a research paper or an article or something like that, is you begin with the points against you, and then you proceed step by step to your increasingly stronger and stronger examples or arguments, and then end with your most powerful point. But I'm going to do the opposite in the interest of time, and the fact that for the people that are listening to this show are probably going to come to the first part first rather than last. So I'm going to talk about what I consider to be the most important aspect of the algorithms I'm presenting for evaluating how much we're asking of ourselves, and could it be possible that we might ask more of ourselves, in what kinds of ways. The very first one, I've got about six or seven main sort of categories of topics here, each of which could really be delved into and developed as ideas. But the very first most important one is time. What do you spend your time doing? How do you spend your time? And so if you ask, you could, every person could sort of make a log of what you do every day and how much time you spend doing different things. Almost all of us spend probably about a third of our life sleeping. And we probably spend about a pretty significant percentage of our waking hours doing stuff like eating and hygiene and traveling. And then also, a large majority of us also have jobs or occupations that we go to several days a week for quite a few hours. So between sleeping, eating, traveling, and working, that's a big chunk out of most people's lives, most people that living in modern Western society. But that does count as time, of course. But what you choose to do, say like if you've got, even if we look at what people do with their free time, that alone would be highly significant. Like how you spend your time. Say like you've got all of a sudden a day opens up with nothing for you to do. What would you do? All things being equal, say like, you know, money wasn't an issue, you had nice weather. Are you going to go shopping? Or are you going to take your boat out and go fishing? Or are you going to go skiing or go and play some tennis? Or are you going to go and buy some paint and sit down and paint some rocks for the first time ever because you've always wanted to? Or are you going to get out your flute or your guitar and play some music? Or are you going to go and seek out some indigenous people in your area and ask if you might be of assistance to them, or even meet them and get to know them? Or, I mean, do you see what I'm saying? What we consciously choose to do with our time is how we create who and what we are. As the artists of our own creation that we each really are, how we use our time is an example of how we use our creativity. I know for myself, there's not enough hours in the day for me to get everything done that I have to do, because I ask a lot of myself, and always have. But as time goes by, I ask even more of myself, and I ask so much of myself that not only are there not enough hours in a day, I don't even know if I'm going to get everything done in this lifetime. That I mean, theoretically, with the creativity I've got, I could spend several consecutive lifetimes just painting, creating. It's mind-blowing to think about. That's just one. You know, and I'm really actually different from a lot of people in the sense of the creative blessings that I have and my inspiration and motivation for why I do the things I do. And the purpose of this show isn't necessarily to contrast my own personal raison d'etre, why I'm here and what I do with my life. But it's very interesting to compare how I spend my time versus how a lot of other people spend their time. And of course, I don't have a full-time job working for somebody else, but I've got the equivalent of several full-time jobs working for Mother Earth and the whales and dolphins and nature, and to honor the beauty and power of being here now. And I take all this probably even more seriously than people with full-time jobs take their job. Why? Because I'm doing all this without getting paid. It's like I'm doing everything as a labor of love, because I truly believe and care about why I'm here and what I'm doing with my life, and to honor the beauty and power of being here now and the creativity that I've been given. Like this radio show, for example. Have I ever made 1 cent from this show? No. In fact, it costs me dearly to do this show. I take it quite seriously. I see it as a public service to share with my friends and anyone who could possibly benefit even one little iota from what I have to say and the people that I interview and the information I share, to try to help to renavigate the human process along the lines of what I've just been talking about. So what I do with my time, for example, I probably spend about between 6 and 10 hours every week creating this radio show. And I'd really like to honor Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV, who does the same thing to keep all these shows going on her network like she has ever since 2012, totally for free. And there's not even any advertising on there or anything. You know, so I'm not a capitalist. I'm not motivated by money, which draws me into challenging situations and even open conflict sometimes with the dominant mentality. But anyway, back to the whole idea of time. What do you spend your time doing? And I could spend many, many hours every day just writing. I could spend many, many hours every day just painting. I could spend many, many, many hours every day playing and recording music and working on musical creativity. I could spend many, many, many hours every day just working on my still photography. I could spend many, many, many hours every day working on my video photography and my filmmaking projects. And I can spend many, many, many hours every day working on all my networking and computer information organization. And then this doesn't leave much time for doing other extremely important things like camping out and being out in nature and going for walks and existing in the real world of the natural wonders of Mother Earth and my family of life. This is how I spend my time. How do you spend your time? Okay. Number two is, where does your sense of reality come from? Now, this is huge and is worthy of an entire show or even a whole book or PhD college curriculum in itself. Where does what we think of as reality come from? And as Rupert Sheldrake, who is rapidly becoming one of my very favorite minds and who I hope to do an interview with for the show or a series of interviews, so much of our whole process is habitual. We're creatures of habit. And that's why we're able to go through our lives being relatively unconscious, because it's sort of like a kind of a psycho-behavioral inertia, where like things tend to keep doing what they're doing unless they're acted upon by an outside force. So you just kind of keep acting out the same basic processes day to day, the same patterns of behavior, the same relationships, same things that you do, the same things that you think, the same things that you eat. And so to become aware of these habitual processes and to realize that we do have the ability to make conscious changes in these, that's a big part of our own personal reality. But if you look at, and I'm not trying to answer these questions for you, I'm just saying, like, if you look, for example, if you want to consciously re-navigate your life and possibly look at ways in which you might be able to ask more of yourself for whatever reason, hopefully not to just sort of like get even higher on the heap, to look better, feel better, and be righter about things, but to be of greater service to humanity, to try to define what your sense of values and meanings really are. How you use your time, where your reality comes from. Now, this is where, of course, if you look at your life, our reality comes from our culture and the language that we speak and all of our personal biggest influences, our teachers and our greatest teachers are our parents and our immediate family and other important authority people in your life, like religious leaders and educators. And in the world of, really since World War II, in which most of the people now have grown up, we've been living in a world with a very vast media environment that's a very significant aspect to what we think of as reality. So how many hours do you sit and spend watching television every day? Very, very, very important question. Ingesting fabricated reality via technology created by other people, not just to educate you or to share information. No, it's a product that you're consuming. It's designed to generate profit at some level for somebody or to foist and further agendas, most of which are completely invisible to the public at large. So there, powers that be, one of the biggest industries in the world is the whole mind management paradigm, which I've dealt with with my concept of infotoxin, or the study of information toxicology, how mass communication has been weaponized, which is another whole huge thing in itself. So we tend to get a lot of our, if not the majority of our belief in what's happening in the world, in our sense of reality, what's important, from external authority figures via mass media, especially television, the news and documentaries, and pretty importantly on the internet as well. A very important example of what people think of as reality in the world of today that I've been observing for, well, very, very attentively for the past decade, and really for a lot longer than that, but the whole socio-political paradigm and modern thought of dealing with what they call global warming or climate change, and watching how this meme, this idea, has sort of permeated every aspect of modern consciousness. But it's not like it just did it on its own, like a drop of water soaking through a sponge. It's like you can see every trick in the book being pulled out by the powers that be behind this. It's being marketed using every psychological communications technique in the whole arsenal of modern mass communication and propaganda and the Bernaysian paradigm of the manufacture of consent. I mean, I could do several shows just talking about all this, but this is an example of, if you believe in climate change as pervaded via mass media or global warming or all that, you know, are you getting all this from? How much actual global warming have you yourself seen or experienced in real life? I'm not talking about on TV. How much climate change? I mean, you know, what even does that mean? You know, do you see climate change in your own life? Like where you are right now or in your recent past, have you seen examples of extreme weather? that's outside the realm of possibility for what Mother Earth has the ability to do? And do you have any reason to believe that this is due to carbon dioxide? I mean, this is just an example of a whole wave of unreality that has sort of swept the whole mind share of modern humanity. But you have to look at, where is this coming from? So these are questions. I'm not answering them for you. So we've got, first, how do you spend your time? Two, where does your reality come from? Where does it come from every day? Are you uncritically assimilating spoon-fed, gerbified pseudo-information from mass media that's designed to make you a clone of the New World Order? That's basically how the powers that be look at us. Or are you spending your time actively seeking knowledge and information from state-of-the-art sources based on things that you'd like to learn more about, and you don't necessarily trust that which is being dribbled out by authoritative media powers that be? You want to find and dig on your own, do some investigative research, some investigative journalism on your own. But no, it takes a lot of time and work to do that. And if you'd rather spend your time going shopping or playing tennis or fishing or going on holiday, you're just not going to have time. It's much easier to just turn on your TV and get your little soundbite of information that'll give you your feel good, be right, look good information, some trendy, you know, save this or save that activities that you can get involved with. It's like people, you know, if you look at people's basic perspective with being here now, a lot of people are on holiday. They're on holiday from reality. And I've always kind of cringed when people ask me if I'm on holiday. So, Jeff, are you just traveling around? You're on holiday. And I go like, no, there's no pre-existing category that you can just stuff me into. It's much more complex than that. But that does describe a lot of people's attitude towards being here now. They're on holiday from reality. In fact, I even came up with a concept for a science fiction comedy movie or a story called 30 Million Light Years from Reality. That's where people are right now. So how do you use your time? Where you get your reality from? And is this an active process or a passive one of just assimilation? Or see, again, it's like, you know, it's a lot of work to think about all this stuff, to be conscious, to be a self-navigating, self-metaprogramming individual rather than just a clone consumer. Which brings me to a very interesting concept. There was a very influential author back in the 1970s named Alvin Toffler, that's T-O-F-F-L-E-R, and he wrote a very well-known book called Future Shock that actually had some very interesting ideas in there. In fact, I might go back and reread it, but I remember in there he draws the distinction between two classes of people. I think he might have even came up with this word. We've got what we think of as consumers. You know, everybody knows what that means. But the opposite of a consumer is a prosumer, P-R-O-S-U-M-E-R. That's someone who creates and makes. So if you're a prosumer of your own reality, that puts you very, very, very far ahead of the consumer, especially with the ability of self-control and self-navigation of your own life and your own determination of who and what you are and what you're becoming. Okay, now third, and all of these things relate, your time, your reality, and what is your motivation when you go out every day, when you wake up? What's your sense of purpose or your motivation? What drives you to do the things you do? And there was an expression in America back that I used to hear all the time. It was called Looking Out for Number One. That's the motto of the me generation, looking out for number one. And it means that you put yourself first. You know, you might say you care about what happens to other people or other life forms, but the bottom line is, you know, it's me first. You know, I've got to make sure I've got plenty of money for me. I've got to make sure that I've got all the stuff I want and need that, you know, like my life and my own individual narrow selfish perspective is infinitely more important than anything else outside of me. So I ask people, I hear a lot of whinging and complaining, and I call them first world problems. People complaining about stuff like, and literally, the bathroom in their new holiday home has the wrong color of tile. Or when I was just on the Big Island of Hawaii last year during the volcanic eruption, someone was complaining on Facebook about how dare Tutu Pele destroy their brand new multi-million dollar holiday home. How dare this volcanic eruption take their home out? And Lloyd's of London was just really taking their time about reimbursing them for their home. And I'm going like, oh my God, make me puke. You know, so these are just isolated examples, but a third world problem is I can't seem to find my children. They're missing after the Israeli air attack on my city. My child's missing one of his hands, or we haven't had any water to drink all this week, or, you know, that kind of thing. So but these are still human problems. We aren't able to hear the voices and the feelings and the cries and the screams of all the koalas that are being driven to extinction. Their homes are being chopped down all up and down the east coast of Australia. Of all the Maui's dolphins and the vaquitas that are being trapped in the fishing nets and blasted with sonar, and all the whales and dolphins that are washing up all over the world, and all the trees that are being chopped down, like my beautiful forest friends there in the Grange in Auckland last week, and all the honeybees and the possums that are being poisoned, and just all the life forms that are screaming in pain and agony with their little voices that we can no longer sense or hear because it's blotted out by our own demented mental operating environment of looking out for number one. So what if you woke up every day, and when you got out of bed, and instead of going like, oh my God, I've got to go to this stupid job, or, you know, how am I gonna make my next $1 million? You know, instead of thinking of purely selfish stuff like that, what if you woke up every day and go like, look, it's so beautiful to be here now. I'm so thankful for the sunshine and the oxygen and the gravity and my fellow life forms and the fact that I exist, and how can I possibly be of service, not only to my fellow man, but to all my fellow life forms? And is it possible for me to ask more of myself? You know, and how might I know in what ways to ask more of myself? What if we renavigated along these lines? So again, we've got, how do you spend your time? Where do you get your reality from? What's your basic motivation or purpose with your life? Fourth, we've got that concept that Carl Sagan said about expanding our horizon of identity. You can talk about your family, who you think of as you. Like, of course, you, yourself, your own individual person. But then you've got your immediate family, your children, your spouse, your mom and dad, your aunts and uncles, your immediate biological relatives, and then you've got your circle of friends, and then you've got your sort of community neighborhood, you've got your town, your village, you've got your state, you've got your country, you've got your species. So there's all different levels of identification. But what if we expanded our horizon of identity to conclude not just all people, but all of life? every living thing, even the evil invasive pests, the rats and the cockroaches and the leeches and the mosquitoes and the possums and the mice and the ants and the flies and all the things that we don't like that we're doing our best to try to eradicate from the planet. What if we honored and nurtured every living being as the true members of our family that they are, and including Mother Earth as a fellow being? And she is definitely not our planet. That's one of the greatest malignant, megalomaniacal expressions I ever heard people say. The Earth is not our planet. Au contraire, we are hers. Not only do we live on her solely by her beneficial grace and gifts of abundance and life, we're made of her. We are hers. We are her children. She is not our planet. We can say she is our mother, but she is not our planet. So expanding your horizon of identity could really make a big change and could be a way of helping to ask more of ourselves. Because if you think of yourself as all of life, who's everyone who's equally important, it can really change how you spend your time. And another really big thing is looking at your levels of health. And this doesn't just mean, are you suffering from any diseases or syndromes or is anything wrong with you? But health implies wholeness. And health is many different levels all at the same time. You've got the physical health, you've got mental health, and we've got spiritual and emotional health. And this is incredibly important, because we as individuals and as our species are the single greatest threat to the health of Mother Earth and all of our family of life that exists and maybe that's ever existed on this planet. So for us to ask more of ourselves and to be aware of ways that we can re-navigate the human process along the lines of what I'm talking about, we might be able to increase and refine and enhance and nurture the health, not only of ourselves, because we are holograms of life, of the universe. And literally, in the quote attributed to Chief Seattle, what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And in the true systems thinking of Fritjof Capra, everything is interconnected and interdependent. Every thought you think does matter. Every second of time, every thought that enters your mind constitutes your mind share. And if each of us is walking around with a, not even just a grateful heart that could be a magnet for miracles, but also with a clear, coherent, and open mind, where we're constantly trying to re-navigate what we're doing and to not be slaves to habit and greed and just looking out for number one, but asking more of ourselves, asking how we might better use our time and increase the health through what we do, and also largely through what we don't do, through what we stop doing. Stop eating meat, stop watching television, stop driving so much. And all of these things we can attenuate or eliminate. We have the option of, we don't need new forms of energy. If we just conserved and were less wasteful and simplified our patterns of consumption and energy and resource use, we wouldn't need new products. We wouldn't need new sources of energy. Anyway, this show is an effort to show that I still do have a degree of faith and hope for humanity, although it is decreasing. But I do think that some kind of planetary catastrophe is going to happen a lot sooner than we think, simply because even if I have hope that we might re-navigate the human process, I think that it's so far out of our control that nothing we can do is going to matter in the tangible planes, but where it will matter is in the spiritual teleological dimensions of lessening the severity of the purification. In the words of the Lorax, don't be a soldier in World War III. Park your car and plant a tree. Use the tube to educate. Leave the plants to vegetate. Ask more of yourself. And remember, on Space Your Birth, there are no passengers. Everyone is crew. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off. Thanks to UCY-TV and On the Brink Radio. Kia Manuia. Aloha. And good day. Good night, mate.
JJ Inc. And when I'm on